As Boyer, 2001, page 203, stresses, something must be done with the corpse, and it has to be something that satisfies or allays competing innate urges of dictatorial power. What seems to have evolved everywhere, a good trick for dealing with a desperate situation, is an elaborate ceremony that removes the dangerous body from the daily environment either by burial or burning. Combined with the interpretation of the persistent firing of the intentional stance habits, shared by all who knew the deceased as the unseen presence of the agent as a spirit, a sort of virtual person created by the survivor's troubled mindsets, and almost as vivid and robust as a live person. What role, if any, does language play in this? Are we the only species of mammal that buries its dead because we're the only species that can talk about what we share when we confront a fresh corpse? Do the burial practices of Neanderthals show that they must have had fully articulate language? These are among the questions we should try to answer. The world's languages are well stocked with verbs for the basic varieties of belief, desire, manipulation. We pretend and lie, but also bluff and suspect and flatter and brag and tempt and dissuade and command and prohibit and disobey, for instance. Was our virtuosity as natural psychologists a prerequisite for our linguistic ability? Or is it the other way around? Did our use of language make our psychological talents possible? This is another controversial area of current research, and probably the truth is, as it so often is, that there was a co-evolutionary process, with each talent feeding off the other. Plausibly, the very act of verbal communication requires some appreciation of third-order intentionality. I have to want you to recognize that I am trying to inform you, to get you to believe what I'm saying. Grice, 1957-1969, Dennett, 1978. But see also Sperber and Wilson, 1986. But like the fledgling cuckoo, a child can get underway quite cluelessly, achieving successful communication without having any reflective appreciation of the structure that underlies all intentional communication, without even recognizing, really, that she is communicating at all. Once you've started talking with other people, you will be bathed in new words, some of which you more or less understand. Some of these objects of perception, such as the words pretend and brag and tempt, will help draw and focus your attention on cases of pretending and bragging and tempting, giving you plenty of inexpensive practice in folk psychology. Whereas chimpanzees and some other mammals may also be natural psychologists, as Nicholas Humphrey, 1978, has called them, since they lack language, they never get to compare notes or discuss cases with other natural psychologists. The articulation of the intentional stance in verbal communication not only heightens the sensitivity, discrimination, and versatility of individual folk psychologists, but also magnifies and complicates the folk psychological phenomena they are attending to. A fox may be cunning, but a person who can flatter you by declaring that you are cunning as a fox has more tricks up his sleeve than the fox does, by a wide margin. Language gave us the power to remind ourselves of things not currently present to our senses, to dwell on topics that would otherwise be elusive. And this brought into focus a virtual world of imagination, populated by the agents that mattered the most to us, both the living but absent and the dead who were gone but not forgotten. Released from the corrective pressure of further actual encounters in the real world, these virtual agents were free to evolve in our minds to amplify our yearnings or our dreads. Absence makes the heart grow fonder or, if the absent one was somewhat frightening in reality, more terrified. This still doesn't get our ancestors to religion, but it gets them to persistent, even obsessive, rehearsal and elaboration of some of their habits of thought. Chapter 4. Extrapolating back to human prehistory with the aid of biological thinking, we can surmise how folk religions emerged without conscious and deliberate design, just as languages emerged, by interdependent processes of biological and cultural evolution. At the root of human belief in gods lies an instinct on a hair trigger, the disposition to attribute agency, beliefs and desires and other mental states, to anything complicated that moves. Chapter 5. The false alarms generated by our overactive disposition to look for agents wherever the action is are the irritants around which the pearls of religion grow. Only the best, most mind-friendly variants propagate by meeting, or seeming to meet, deep psychological and physical needs. And then these are further refined by the incessant pruning of selection processes. Chapter 5. Religion, the Early Days. 1. Too many agents. Competition for rehearsal space. I might repeat to myself slowly and soothingly a list of quotations beautiful from minds profound. If I can remember any of the damn things. Dorothy Parker. What start as useful luxuries that give you an edge in a fast-moving world have a way of evolving into necessities. Today we all wonder how we could live without our telephones, our driver's licenses, our credit cards, our computers. So it once was with language, and the intentional stance. What started as a good trick rapidly became a practical necessity of human life. As our ancestors became more and more social, more and more linguistic. And, as already noted for the simpler case of the had, there is the possibility of too much of a good thing. The continued experience of the presence of departed acquaintances as ghosts is not the only overshooting of the intentional stance in the lives of our ancestors. The practice of over-attributing intentions to moving things in the environment is called animism, literally giving a soul, Latin anima, to the mover. People who lovingly cajole their cranky automobiles or curse at their computers are exhibiting fossil traces of animism. They probably don't take their own speech acts entirely seriously, but are just indulging in something that makes them feel better. The fact that it does tend to make them feel better, and is apparently indulged in by people of every culture, suggests how deeply rooted in human biology is the urge to treat things, especially frustrating things, as agents with beliefs and desires. But if our bouts of animism today tend to be ironic and attenuated, there was a time when the desire of the river to flow to the sea and the benign or evil intent of the rain clouds were taken so literally and seriously that they could become a matter of life or death. For instance, to those poor souls who were sacrificed to appease the insatiable desires of the rain god. Simple forms of what we might call practical animism are arguably not mistakes at all, but extremely useful ways of keeping track of the tendencies of designed things, living or artifactual. The gardener who tries to discover what her different flowers and vegetables prefer, or tricks a dogwood branch into thinking it's spring and opening its buds by bringing it indoors where it is warm, doesn't have to go overboard and wonder what her petunias are daydreaming about. Even undesigned physical systems can sometimes be usefully described in intentional or animistic terms. The river doesn't literally want to return to the ocean, but water seeks its own level, as they say, and lightning searches for the best path to ground. It is not surprising that the attempt to explain patterns discerned in the world has often hit upon animism as a good, actually predictive, approximation of some unimaginably complex underlying phenomenon. But sometimes the tactic of seeking an intentional stance perspective comes up dry. Much as our ancestors would have loved to predict the weather by figuring out what it wanted and what beliefs it harbored about them, it simply didn't work. It no doubt often seemed to work, however. Every now and then the rain dances were rewarded by rain. What would the effect be? Many years ago, the behavioral psychologist B.F. Skinner, 1948, showed a striking superstition effect in pigeons that were put on a random schedule of reinforcement. Every so often, no matter what the pigeon was doing at the moment, a click and a food pellet reward were delivered. Soon, the pigeons put on this random schedule were doing elaborate dances, bobbing and whirling and craning their necks. It's hard to resist putting a soliloquy into these birds' brains. Now let's see, the last time I got the reward, I'd just spun around once and craned my neck. Let's try it again. Nope, no reward. Perhaps I didn't spin enough. Nope. Perhaps I should bob once before spinning and craning. Yes, okay, now, what did I just do? You don't have to have language, of course, to be vulnerable to such enticing illusions. The soliloquy dramatizes the dynamics that produce the effect, which doesn't require conscious reflection, just reinforcement. But in a species that does represent both itself and other agents to itself, the effect can be multiplied. If such a strikingly extravagant behavioral effect can be produced in pigeons by making them wander into a random reinforcement trap, it is not hard to believe that similar effects could be inculcated by happy accident in our ancestors, whose built-in love for the intentional stance would tend to encourage them to add invisible agents or other homunculi to be the secret puppeteers behind the perplexing phenomena. Clouds certainly don't look like agents with beliefs and desires, so it is no doubt natural to suppose that they are indeed inert and passive things, being manipulated by hidden agents that do look like agents, rain gods and cloud gods and the like, if only we could see them. This curiously paradoxical idea, something invisible that looks like a person, has a head, eyes, arms, and legs, perhaps wears a special helmet, is different from other self-contradictory combinations. Consider the idea of a box that has no interior space to put things in, or a liquid that isn't wet. To put it crudely, these ideas are not interesting enough to be puzzling for very long. Some nonsense is more attention-grabbing than other nonsense. Why? Just because our memories are not indifferent to the content of what they store. Some things we find more memorable than others, and some things are so interesting that they are well-nigh unforgettable. And still others, such as the random string of words, volunteers, trainer, regardless, court exercise, pulled by me at random from the first newspaper story I could lay my hands on just now, could be remembered for more than a few seconds only if you either deliberately repeated it to yourself dozens of times or made up some interesting story that somehow made sense of these words in just this sequence. We are all painfully aware today that our attention is a limited commodity with many competitors vying for more than their share. This information overload with advertisements bombarding us on all sides, plus a host of other distractions, is nothing new. We've just become self-conscious about it now that there are thousands of people who specialize in designing novel attention grabbers and attention holders. We, and indeed all animate species, have always had to have filters and biases built into our nervous systems to screen the passing show for things worth hanging on to. And these filters favor certain sorts of exceptions or anomalies. Pascal Boyer, 2001, calls these exceptions counterintuitive. But he means this in a rather circumscribed technical sense. Counterintuitive anomalies are especially attention-worthy and memorable if they violate just one or two of the basic default assumptions about a fundamental category like person or plant or tool. Concoctions that aren't readily classifiable at all because they are too nonsensical can't hold their own in the competition for attention. And concoctions that are too bland are just not interesting enough. An invisible axe with no handle and a spherical head is just irritating nonsense. An axe made of cheese is a bit titillating. There are conceptual artists who make a good living coming up with such japes. But a talking axe? Ah, now we've got something to hold the attention. Put these two ideas together. A hyperactive, agent-seeking bias and a weakness for certain sorts of memorable combos. And you get a kind of fiction-generating contraption. Every time something puzzling happens, it triggers a sort of curiosity startle, a who's-there response that starts churning out hypotheses of sorts. Maybe it's Sam, maybe it's a wolf, maybe it's a falling branch, maybe it's a tree that can walk. Hey, maybe it's a tree that can walk. We can suppose that this process almost never generates anything with any staying power. Millions or billions of little stretches of fantasy that almost instantly evaporate beyond recall until one day one happens to occur at just the right moment with just the right sort of zing to get rehearsed, not just once and not just twice, but many times. A lineage of ideas, the walking tree lineage, is born. Every time the initiator's mind is led to review the curious idea, not deliberately but just idly, the idea gets a little stronger. In the sense of a little more likely to occur in the initiator's mind again. and again. It has a little self-replicative power, a little more self-replicative power than the other fantasies it competes with for time in the brain. It is not yet a meme, an item that escapes an individual mind and spreads through human culture, but it is a good proto-meme, a slightly obsessional, that is oft-recurring, oft-rehearsed, little hobby horse of an idea. Evolution is all about processes that almost never happen. Every birth in every lineage is a potential speciation event, but speciation almost never happens, not once in a million births. Mutation in DNA almost never happens, not once in a trillion copyings, but evolution depends on it. Take the set of infrequent accidents, things that almost never happen, and sort them into the happy accidents, the neutral accidents, and the fatal accidents. Amplify the effects of the happy accidents, which happen automatically when you have replication and competition, and you get evolution. Would-be mimeticists often ignore the fact that part of the life cycle of a meme is its moment-to-moment competition with other ideas. Not just other memes, but every other idea anybody can think about within a host brain. Rehearsal, deliberate or involuntary, is replication. We can try to make something a meme or just a memory by rehearsing it deliberately. A phone number, a rule to follow, or if we just let nature take its course, our innate brain biases will automatically churn out rehearsals of the things that tickle them. This is probably the source, in fact, of episodic memory, our ability to recollect events in our lives. What did you have for breakfast on your last birthday? You probably can't remember. What did you wear at your wedding? You probably can remember because you've gone over it many times before, during, and since the wedding. Unlike computer memory, which is an equal opportunity storehouse that can readily record whatever is thrown into it, human brain memory is both competitive and biased. It has been designed by eons of evolution to remember some sorts of things more readily than others. It does this in part by differential rehearsal, dwelling on what is vital and tending to discard the trivia after a single pass. It does a pretty good job keying on features that happen to have lined up with what tended to be vital in the past. Good advice to a potential meme is, if you want lots of rehearsals, replications, try to look important. Human memory is biased in favor of vital combinations, but so presumably is the memory found in the brains of all other animals. Animal memory has probably been relatively impervious to fantasy, however, for a simple reason. Lacking language, animal brains have not had a way of inundating themselves with an explosion of combinations not found in the natural environment. How is an anxious ape going to concoct the counterintuitive combination of a walking tree or an invisible banana? Ideas that might indeed captivate an ape mind, if only they could be presented to it. Do we know that something like this fantasy generation process has been taking place in our species and our species alone for thousands of years? No, but it is a serious possibility to investigate further. Using only materials that would have been put in place by evolution for other purposes, this hypothesis could explain the remarkably fertile imagination that must somehow be responsible for the world's menagerie of mythical creatures and demons. Since the monsters themselves have never existed, they had to be invented either deliberately or inadvertently, the way languages were invented. They are expensive creations, and the R&D required for the task had to be generated by something that could pay for itself. I've left the hypothesis quite unspecific for the moment, but more constrained forms of it are available, and they have the great advantage of having testable consequences. We can start scouring the world's mythology for patterns that would be predicted by some versions of the hypothesis, but not others. And we don't have to restrict ourselves to the human species. Experiments along the lines of Skinner's provocation of superstition in the pigeon might begin to uncover the biases and fault lines in ape memory mechanisms, in much the way Nico Tinbergen's experiments with gulls, 1948-1959, famously showed their perceptual biases. The adult female gull has an orange spot on her beak, at which her chicks instinctually peck, to stimulate the female to regurgitate and feed them. Tinbergen showed the chicks would peck even more readily at exaggerated cardboard models of the orange spot, so-called supernormal stimuli. Pascal Boyer, 2001, notes that over the eons, human beings have discovered and exploited their own supernormal stimuli. There is no human society without some musical tradition. Although the traditions are very different, some principles can be found everywhere. For instance, musical sounds are always closer to pure sound than to noise. To exaggerate a little, what you get from musical sounds are supervowels, the pure frequencies as opposed to the mixed ones that define ordinary vowels, and pure consonants, produced by rhythmic instruments and the attack of most instruments. These properties make music an intensified form of sound experience from which the cortex receives purified and therefore intense doses of what usually activates it. This phenomenon is not unique to music. Humans everywhere also fill their environments with artifacts that overstimulate their visual cortex, for instance by providing pure saturated color, instead of the dull browns and greens of their familiar environments. In the same way, our visual system is sensitive to symmetries in objects. Bilateral symmetry in particular is quite important. When two sides of an animal or person look the same, it means that they are facing you. A relevant feature of interaction with people, but also with prey and predators. Again, you cannot find a human group where people do not produce visual gadgets with such symmetrical arrangements, from the simplest makeup or hairdressing techniques to textile patterns and interior decoration. Pages 132-33. Why don't other species have art? Once again, the answer that suggests itself, which does not mean that it is proven, but only that it may well be provable, is that lacking language, they lack the tools for creating surrogate stimulus combinations, and hence they lack the perspective that permits exploration of the combinatorics of their own senses. Using acute observation and trial and error, Tinbergen cleverly devised the supernormal stimuli that enticed his birds and other animals into a host of bizarre behaviors. No doubt animals do on occasion trap themselves by inadvertently discovering a supernormal stimulus in nature and letting it do its thing on them, but what would they do next? Do it again if it felt good, but the generation of diversity on which true design exploration depends would probably not be possible for them. To sum up the story so far, the memorable nymphs and fairies and goblins and demons that crowd the mythologies of every people are the imaginative offspring of a hyperactive habit of finding agency wherever anything puzzles or frightens us. This mindlessly generates a vast overpopulation of agent ideas, most of which are too stupid to hold our attention for an instant. Only a well-designed few make it through the rehearsal tournament, mutating and improving as they go. The ones that get shared and remembered are the souped-up winners of billions of competitions for rehearsal time in the brains of our ancestors. This is not a new idea, of course, just a clarification and extension of an idea that has been around for generations. As Darwin himself surmised, the belief in unseen or spiritual agencies seems to be almost universal, nor is it difficult to comprehend how it arose. As soon as the important faculties of the imagination, wonder, and curiosity, together with some power of reasoning, had become partially developed, man would naturally have craved to understand what was passing around him, and have vaguely speculated on his own existence. 1886, page 65. So far, so good. But what we have accounted for is superstition, not religion. Hunting for elves in the garden or the boogeyman under your bed is not yet having a religion. What is missing? For one thing, belief. For although Darwin speaks of belief in spiritual entities, we have not yet provided an account that secures anything so strong as that. Nothing has yet been said about having to believe the hobby horse idea that keeps recycling through your mind. It may be a hunch or a wonder or even an obsessively disbelieved little nugget of paranoia, or just a captivating morsel of storyline. Nobody has ever believed in Cinderella or Little Red Riding Hood, but their fairy tales have been quite faithfully transmitted with mutations over many generations. Many fairy tales make up for not being true stories by having a moral, which gives them an apparent value to the tellers and hearers, that makes up for their not being information about the wide world. Others conspicuously lack a moral. Just what does Goldilocks teach our children, not to invade strangers' houses? and must persist in the transmission tournament for less obvious reasons. As is usual in evolutionary circumstances, a gradual ramp of indeterminate states of mind is there to be traversed. From shuddering doubt, are there really wicked witches in the woods? And neutral fascination, a flying carpet, just imagine. Through nagging uncertainty, unicorns. Well, I've never seen one. And on to robust conviction. Satan is as real as that horse over there. Fascination is enough to power rehearsal and replication. Almost everybody has a good strong copy of the idea of unicorns, though few people believe in them, but hardly anybody has the idea of poodoos, which have the distinct advantage of being real. You can look it up. There is a lot more to religion than a fascination with counterintuitive, agent-like entities. 2. Gods as interested parties. Why the gods above me, who must be in the know, think so little of me, they allow you to go. Cole Porter, Every Time We Say Goodbye. Ancestor worship must be an appealing idea to those who are about to become ancestors. Steven Pinker, How the Mind Works. Whereas other species make limited use of the intentional stance for anticipating the moves of predator and prey, plus a little bullying and bluffing, we human beings are obsessed about our personal relations with others, worrying about our reputations, our unfulfilled promises and obligations, and reviewing our affections and loyalties. Unlike other species, which have to worry all the time about lurking predators and dwindling food sources, we human beings have largely traded in these pressing concerns for others. The price our species has paid for the security of living in large groups of interacting communicators with different agendas is having to keep track of these complex agendas and shifting relationships. Whom can I trust? Who trusts me? Who are my rivals and my friends? To whom do I owe debts? And whose debts to me should I forgive or collect? The human world is teeming with such strategic information, to use Pascal Boyer's term, and what matters most about it, as in a card game, is this. In social interaction, we presume that other people's access to strategic information is neither perfect nor automatic. 2001, page 155. Does she know that I know that she wants to leave her husband? Does anybody know that I stole that pig? All the plots of all the great sagas and tragedies and novels, but also all the situation comedies and comic books, hinge on the tensions and complexities that arise because agents in the world don't all share the same strategic information. How do people deal with all this complexity? Sometimes, when people are learning a new card game, they are advised by their teacher to lay all their cards face up on the table, so everybody can see what the others are holding. This is an excellent way of teaching the tactics of the game. It provides a temporary crutch for the imagination. You actually get to see what each person would normally be hiding, so you get to base your reasoning on the facts. You don't have to keep track of them in your head, since you can just look down on the table whenever you need a reminder. This helps you build up skill in visualizing where the cards must be when they are hidden. What works at the card table can't be done in real life. We can't get people to divulge all their secrets during a practice session of life. But we can get practice offline by telling and listening to stories, narrated by an agent who sees all the cards of the fictional or historic characters. What if there really were agents who had access to all the strategic information? What an idea. It is easy enough to see that such a being, in Boyer's terms a full-access agent, would be an attention-grabbing concoction. But aside from that, what good would it be? Why would it be any more important to people than any other fantasy? Well, it might help people simplify the thinking that has to be done to figure out what to do next. A survey of the world's religions shows that almost always the full-access agents turn out to be ancestors. Gone, but not at all forgotten. As the memory of father is burnished and elaborated in many retellings to children and grandchildren and their grandchildren, his ghost may acquire many exotic properties. But at the heart of his image is his virtuosity in the strategic information department. Remember how your mother and father often seemed to know just what you were thinking, just what mischief you were trying to hide? Ancestors are like that, only more so. You can't hide from them, not even your secret thoughts, and nobody else can either. Now you can reframe your puzzlement about what to do next. What would my ancestors want me to do in my current situation? You may not be able to tell what these vividly imagined agents would want you to do, but whatever it is, it's what you should do. Why, though, do we human beings so consistently focus our fantasies on our ancestors? Nietzsche, Freud, and many other theorists of culture have articulated elaborate conjectures about the subliminal motivations and memories that arose from mythic struggles deep in our human past. And there may be substantial gold to be refined from this load of speculation once we re-examine it with an eye to testable hypotheses of evolutionary psychology. But in the meantime, we can more confidently identify the basic mental disposition that sets up this bias, for it is considerably older than our species. Mammals and birds, unlike most other animals, often devote considerable parental attention to their young. But there is wide variation in this. Precocial species are those in which the young hit the ground running, as the saying goes, whereas altricial species have young that require prolonged parental care and training. This training period provides a host of opportunities for information transmission from parent to offspring that bypasses the genes entirely. Biologists are often accused of gene centrism, thinking that everything in biology is explained by the action of genes. And some biologists do indeed go overboard in their infatuation with genes. They should be reminded that Mother Nature is not a gene centrist. That is, the process of natural selection itself doesn't require that all valuable information move through the germline via the genes. On the contrary, if the burden can be reliably taken over by continuities in the external world, that is fine with Mother Nature. It takes a load off the genome. Consider the various continuities relied on by natural selection, those supplied by the fundamental laws of physics, gravity, etc., and those supplied by the long-term stabilities of environment that can be safely expected to persevere. Salinity of the ocean, composition of the atmosphere, colors of things that can be used as triggers, etc. To say that natural selection relies on these regularities means just this. It generates mechanisms that are tuned to work well in environments that exhibit those regularities. The design of these mechanisms presupposes these regularities in the same way that the design of a Mars rover presupposes the planet's gravity, the solidity and temperature range of its surface, and so forth. It is not designed to operate in the Everglades, for instance. Then there are the regularities that can be transmitted from generation to generation by social learning. These are a special case of reliable environmental regularities. They take on further importance since they are themselves subject to natural selection, directly and indirectly. Two information superhighways have been improved and enlarged over the eons. The genetic informational pathways have themselves been subject to incessant refinement over billions of years. With optimization of chromosome design and invention and improvement of proofreading enzymes and so forth, with the effect that high-fidelity, high-bandwidth transmission of genetic information has been achieved. The parent-child instructional pathway has also been optimized by a recursive or iterative process of enhancement. As Avital and Jablonka, 2000, note, the evolution of the transmission of mechanisms of transmission is of central importance for the evolution of learning and behavior. Page 132. Among the adaptations for improving the bandwidth and fidelity of parent-offspring transmission is imprinting, in which the newborn has a readily triggered and powerful instinctual urge to approach and stay close to and attend to the first large moving thing it sees. In mammals, the urge to find and cling to the nipple is hardwired by the genes, and it has the side effect, opportunistically exploited by further adaptations, of keeping the young where they can watch mother when they are not feeding. Human infants are no exception to the mammalian rules. Meanwhile, going in the other direction, parents have been genetically designed to attend to infants. Whereas gull chicks are irresistibly drawn to an orange spot, human beings are irresistibly captivated by the special proportions of a baby face. It brings out the, "Aw, isn't she cunning?" response in the steeliest curmudgeons. As Conrad Lorenz, 1950, and others have argued, the correlation between an infant's facial appearance and an adult's nurturing response is no accident. It is not that baby faces are somehow intrinsically darling. What on earth could that mean? But that evolution hit upon facial proportions as the signal to trigger parental responses. And this has been refined and intensified over the eons in many lineages. We don't love babies and puppies because they're cute. It's the other way around. We see them as cute because evolution has designed us to love things that look like that. So strong is the correlation that measurements of fossils of newborn dinosaurs have been used to support the radical hypothesis that some dinosaur species were altricial. Hopson 1977, Horner 1984. Stephen Jay Gould's classic analysis, 1980, of the gradual juvenilization over the years of Mickey Mouse's features provides an elegant demonstration of the way cultural evolution can parallel genetic evolution, homing in on what human beings instinctually prefer. But even more potent than the bias in adults to respond parentally to baby-faced young is the bias in those young to respond with obedience to parental injunction, a trait observable in bear cubs as well as human babies. The free-floating rationale is not far to seek. It is in the genetic interests of parents, but not necessarily other conspecifics, to inform, not misinform, their young, so it is efficient and relatively safe to trust one's parents. Sterelny, 2003, has particularly acute observations on the trade-offs between trust and suspicion in the evolutionary arms races of cognition. Once the information superhighway between parent and child is established by genetic evolution, it is ready to be used, or abused, by any agents with agendas of their own, or by any memes that happen to have features that benefit from the biases built into the highway. One's parents, or whoever are hard to distinguish from one's parents, have something approaching a dedicated hotline to acceptance, not as potent as hypnotic suggestion, but sometimes close to it. Many years ago, my 5-year-old daughter, attempting to imitate the gymnast Nadia Comaneci's performance on the horizontal bar, tipped over the piano stool and painfully crushed 2 of her fingertips. How was I going to calm down this terrified child so I could safely drive her to the emergency room? Inspiration struck. I held my own hand near her throbbing little hand and sternly ordered, "Look, Andrea, I'm going to teach you a secret. You can push the pain into my hand with your mind. Go ahead, push, push." She tried, and it worked. She'd pushed the pain into Daddy's hand. Her relief and fascination were instantaneous. The effect lasted only for minutes, but with a few further administrations of impromptu hypnotic analgesia along the way, I got her to the emergency room where they could give her the further treatment she needed. Try it with your own child if the occasion arises. You may be similarly lucky. I was exploiting her instincts, though the rationale didn't occur to me until years later when I was reflecting on it. This raises an interesting empirical question. Would my attempt at instant hypnosis have worked as effectively on some other 5-year-old who hadn't imprinted on me as an authority figure? And if imprinting is implicated, how young must a child be to imprint so effectively on a parent? Our daughter was 3 months old when we adopted her. Natural selection builds child's brains with a tendency to believe whatever their parents and tribal elders tell them. Dawkins, 2004a, page 12. It is not surprising, then, to find religious leaders in every part of the world hitting upon the extra authority provided them by their taking on the title father. But this is to get ahead of our story. We're still at the stage where, Boyer claims, our ancestors were unwittingly summoning up fantasies about their ancestors in order to relieve some of their quandaries about what to do next. An important feature of Boyer's hypothesis is that these imagined full-access agents are not typically deemed to be omniscient. If you lose your knife, you don't automatically suppose that they would know the whereabouts of your knife unless somebody stole it from you or you dropped it in an incriminating place during a tryst. Unless, that is, it was strategic information. And the ancestors know all the strategic information because they are interested in it. What you and your kin do is of concern to them for the same reason it is of concern to your parents, and for the same reason it matters to you what your children do and how they are perceived in the community. Boyer's suggestion is that the idea of omniscience, a God who knows absolutely everything about everything, including where your car keys are, the largest prime number smaller than a quadrillion, and the number of grains of sand on that beach, is a later wrinkle, a bit of sophistication or intellectual tidying up much more recently adopted by theologians. There is some experimental evidence in support of this hypothesis. People have been taught since childhood and hence will avow that God knows everything. But they don't rely on this when reasoning unself-consciously about God. The root idea, the one that people actually use when they are not worrying about theological correctness, Barrett 2000, is that the ancestors or the gods know the things that matter the most, the secret longings and schemes and worries and pangs of guilt. Gods know where all the bodies are buried, as the saying goes. 3. Getting the gods to speak to us. Nothing is more difficult and therefore more precious than to be able to decide. Napoleon Bonaparte. But what good to us is the gods' knowledge if we can't get it from them? How could one communicate with the gods? Our ancestors, while they were alive, stumbled on an extremely ingenious solution, divination. We all know how hard it is to make the major decisions of life. Should I hang tough or admit my transgression? Should I move or stay in my present position? Should I go to war or not? Should I follow my heart or my head? We still haven't figured out any satisfactory, systematic way of deciding these things. Anything that can relieve the burden of figuring out how to make these hard calls is bound to be an attractive idea. Consider flipping a coin, for instance. Why do we do it? To take away the burden of having to find a reason for choosing A over B. We like to have reasons for what we do, but sometimes nothing sufficiently persuasive comes to mind, and we recognize that we have to decide soon, so we concoct a little gadget, an external thing that will make the decision for us. But if the decision is about something momentous, like whether to go to war or marry or confess, anything like flipping a coin would just be too, well, flippant. In such a case, choosing for no good reason would be too obviously a sign of incompetence. And besides, if the decision is really that important, once the coin has landed, you'll have to confront the further choice. Should you honor your just avowed commitment to be bound by the flip of the coin, or should you reconsider? Faced with such quandaries, we recognize the need for some treatment stronger than a coin flip. Something more ceremonial, more impressive, like divination, which not only tells you what to do, but gives you a reason. If you squint just right and use your imagination. Scholars have uncovered a comically variegated profusion of ancient ways of delegating important decisions to uncontrollable externalities. Instead of flipping a coin, you can flip arrows, bellomancy, or rods, rhabdomancy, or bones or cards, sortilage, and instead of looking at tea leaves, tassiography, you can examine the livers of sacrificed animals, hepatoscopy, or other entrails, haruspicy, or melted wax poured into water, ceroscopy. Then there is moleosophy, divination by blemishes, myomancy, divination by rodent behavior, nephomancy, divination by clouds, and of course the old favorites numerology and astrology, among dozens of others. One of the more plausible arguments made by Julian Jaynes in his brilliant but quirky and unreliable book, The Origins of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, 1976, was that this riotous explosion of different ways of passing the buck to an external deciding gadget was a manifestation of human beings' growing difficulties with self-control, as human groups became larger and more complicated. Chapter 4, A Change of Mind in Mesopotamia. Pages 223 through 54. And as Palmer and Stedman have more recently noted, the most important effect of divination is that it reduces responsibility in decision-making, and thereby reduces the acrimony that can result from bad decisions. 2004, page 145. The free-floating rationale is obvious enough. If you're going to pass the buck, pass it to something that can't duck the responsibility in turn. And it can be held responsible if things don't go well. And as usual with adaptations, you don't have to understand the rationale to benefit from it. Divination, what Jaynes called exopsychic methods of thought or decision-making, page 245, could have risen in popularity simply because those who happened to do it liked the results enough to do it again and again. And then others began to copy them, and it became the thing to do, even though nobody really knew why. Jaynes noted, page 240, that the very idea of randomness or chance is of quite recent origin. In earlier times, there was no way of even suspecting that some event was utterly random. Everything was presumed to mean something if only we knew what. Deliberately opting for a meaningless choice just to get some choice or other made, so one can get on with one's life, is probably a much later sophistication, even if that is the rationale that explains why it was actually useful to people. In the absence of that sophistication, it was important to believe that somebody somewhere who knows what's right is telling you. Like Dumbo's magic feather. Some crutches for the soul work only if you believe that they do. But what does it mean to say that such a method works? Only that it actually helps people think about their strategic predicaments and then make timely decisions, even if the decisions themselves are not any better informed by the process. This is not nothing. In fact, it could be a tremendous boost under various circumstances. Suppose that people facing difficult decisions typically have all the information they need to make well-grounded decisions, but just don't realize that they do, or just don't trust their own judgment as much as they ought to. All they need to get them out of their funk and stiffen their spine for resolute action is a little help from their friends, their imagined ancestors hovering invisibly nearby and telling them what to do. Such a psychological asset would be jeopardized by skeptics going around poo-pooing the integrity of divination, of course, and probably that recognition, even if subliminal and unarticulated, has always motivated hostility toward skeptics. Shh, don't break the spell. These people need this crutch to keep their act together. Even if people are not, in general, capable of making good decisions on the information that they have, it may seem to them that divination helps them think about their strategic predicaments, and this may provide the motivation to cling to the practice. For reasons they can't fathom, divination provides relief and makes them feel good, rather like tobacco. And note that none of this is genetic transmission. We're talking about a culturally transmitted practice of divination, not an instinct. We don't have to settle the empirical question now of whether divination memes are mutualist memes that actually enhance the fitness of their hosts or parasite memes that they'd be better off without. Eventually, it would be good to get an evidence-based answer to this question, but for the time being, it is the questions I am interested in. Notice, too, that this leaves wide open the possibility that divination, under specific circumstances to be discovered and confirmed, is a mutualist meme because it's true. Because there is a God who knows what is in everyone's heart, and on special occasions tells people what to do. After all, the reason why water is deemed essential to life in every human culture is that it is essential to life. For the moment, though, my point is just that divination, which appears just about everywhere in human culture, including, of course, among the astrology seekers and numerologists who still inhabit our high-tech Western culture, could be understood as a natural phenomenon, paying for itself in the biological coin of replication, whether or not it is actually a source of reliable information, strategic or otherwise. 4. Shamans as hypnotists. Anyone who goes to a psychiatrist should have his head examined. Samuel Goldwyn. Divination is one genus of rituals found throughout the world. Healing rituals conducted by local shamans, or witch doctors, are another. How did it arise? In Guns, Germs, and Steel, 1997, Jared Diamond showed that, to a first approximation, in every culture on every continent, human exploration over the centuries has discovered all the local edible plants and animals, including many that require elaborate preparation to make them non-poisonous. Moreover, they have domesticated whatever local species have been amenable to domestication. We have had the time, intelligence, and curiosity to have made a near-exhaustive search of the possibilities. Something that can now be proved by high-tech methods of genetic analysis of domesticated species and their closest wild relatives. It stands to reason, then, that we should also have done an excellent job of uncovering most, if not all, the locally available medicinal herbs, even those requiring elaborate refinement and preparation. So powerful and reliable have these search procedures proved to be that pharmaceutical companies have in recent years invested in anthropological research, energetically acquiring, by theft in some cases, the fruits of this primitive R&D by the indigenous populations in every rainforest and remote island. This eager appropriation of the intellectual property rights and trade secrets of economically naive peoples is, however deplorable, an excellent instance of the cui bono reasoning of evolutionary biology. R&D is expensive and time-consuming. Whatever information has stood the test of time, replicating through the ages, must have paid for itself somehow, so it is probably worth plagiarizing. Cui bono? It may have paid for itself by helping a long line of tricksters dupe their clients. So we mustn't assume the payment was a benefit for all parties. That people take herbs to alleviate their symptoms or even cure their conditions is not puzzling or surprising, but why all the accompanying, and often horrifying, rituals? Anthropologist James McLennan, 2002, has examined the patterns in rituals of healers all over the world, and finds that they strongly support the hypothesis that what people have discovered over and over again is the placebo effect, more specifically the power of hypnotism, often aided by ingestion or inhalation of hallucinogens or other mind-altering substances. See also Shoemaker, 1990. Ritual healing, McLennan argues, is ubiquitous because it actually works. Not perfectly, of course, but much better than the Western medical establishment has typically been willing to grant. Indeed, there is a convergence. The ailments that people go to and pay shamans to alleviate are those that are particularly hospitable to placebo effect treatment, psychological stress and its attendant symptoms, as well as the ordeals of childbirth, to name perhaps the most interesting case. Childbirth in Homo sapiens is a particularly stressful event, and, of course, the timing of its arrival, unlike the traumas of accidents and hostility, can be anticipated quite accurately, making it an ideal occasion for elaborate ceremonies requiring considerable preparation time. Since infant and maternal mortality rates in childbirth were presumably as high in pre-technological days as they are now in non-technological cultures, there has been plenty of room for a strong selection pressure for the co-evolution of any treatment, culturally transmitted, and susceptibility to treatment, genetically transmitted, that could improve the odds. Just as lactose tolerance has evolved in peoples who had the culture of dairy herding, hypnotizability could have evolved in peoples who had the culture of healing rituals. I hypothesize that shamanic rituals constitute hypnotic inductions, that shamanic performances provide suggestions, that client responses are equivalent to responses produced by hypnosis, and that responses to shamanic treatment are correlated with patient hypnotizability. McLennan, 2002, page 79. These hypotheses are eminently testable. And, McLennan argues, they plausibly provide sources for some of the features, rituals, and beliefs, to be found just about everywhere in religions. Interestingly, there is wide variation in hypnotizability, with about 15% of human populations exhibiting strong hypnotizability, and there is apparently a genetic component, which is not, to my knowledge, well studied yet. Shamans tend to run in families, according to a wealth of anthropological evidence, but this could, of course, be due entirely to vertical cultural transmission of the shamanic memes from parent to child. But why should human beings be susceptible to the placebo effect in the first place? Is this a unique human adaptation, depending on language and culture? Or are any related effects discernible in other species? This is a topic of current research and controversy. One of the most ingenious hypotheses under discussion is Nicholas Humphrey's 2002, Economic Resource Management Hypothesis. The body has many resources to cure its own ailments, pain to discourage activity that can further damage an injury, fevers to combat infection, vomiting to rid the digestive system of toxins, and immune responses to mention the most powerful. These are all effective but costly. Overuse or premature use by the body could actually end up harming the body more than helping. Full-scale immune responses are particularly costly. And only the healthiest animals can maintain a fully equipped army of antibodies. When should a body spare no expense in hopes of a quick cure? Only when it is safe to do so, or when help is just around the corner. Otherwise, it might be more prudent for the body to be stingy with its costly self-treatments. The placebo effect, according to this hypothesis, is a releasing trigger, telling the body to pull out all the stops because there is hope. In other species, the hope variable is presumably tuned to whatever information the animal can glean from its current surroundings. Is it safe in its den or in the middle of its herd, and is there plenty of food around? In us, the hope variable can be manipulated by authoritative figures. These are questions worth further investigation. In Chapter 3, I briefly introduced the hypothesis that our brains might have evolved a God center, but noted that it would be better for the time being to consider it a Whatsis center that had later been adapted or exploited by religious elaborations of one sort or another. Now we have a plausible candidate for filling in the blank. The hypnotizability enabler. Moreover, in his recent book, The God Gene, the neurobiologist and geneticist Dean Hamer, 2004, claims to have found a gene that could be harnessed for this role. The VMAT2 gene is one of many that provide recipes for the proteins that do the work in the brain, helping to create and regulate the molecules that carry the signals that somehow combine to compose all our thoughts and behavior. VMAT2 makes a protein that transports a monoamine. The mood-changing drug Prozac also adjusts the activity of monoamines, such as dopamine and serotonin. But there are many other psychoactive or mood-changing drugs developed in recent years that work by enhancing or suppressing the activity of other neuromodulators and neurotransmitters. The VMAT2 gene is polymorphic in human beings, meaning that there are different mutations of it in different people. The VMAT2 gene variants are well placed, then, to account for differences in people's emotional or cognitive responses to the same stimuli, and could explain why some people are relatively immune to hypnotic induction, whereas others are readily put into a trance. None of this is close to proven yet. Other polymorphic genes have the same potential, and Hamer's development of his hypothesis is marked by more enthusiasm than subtlety, a foible that may repel researchers who would otherwise take it seriously. Still, something like his hypothesis, but probably much more complicated, is a good bet for confirmation in the near future, as the role of proteins and their gene recipes are further analyzed. Part of what is tantalizing about this research avenue is how non-reductionistic it is. McLennan and Hamer have worked independently of each other so far as I know. Neither mentions the other in any case, and neither is treated by Boyer or Atrin or the other anthropologists. This is not surprising. The collaboration between geneticists and neurobiologists on the one hand, and anthropologists and archaeologists and historians on the other, pioneered by Luigi Luca Cavalli Sforza and his colleagues, is a recent and spotty trend. False starts and disappointments are bound to outnumber triumphs in the early days of such interdisciplinary work. And I make no promises about the prospects of the specific hypotheses of either McLennan or Hamer. They make a vivid and accessible example of the possibilities in store, however. Recall Dawkins's point quoted in Chapter 3. If neuroscientists find a God center in the brain, Darwinian scientists like me want to know why the God center evolved. Why did those of our ancestors who had a genetic tendency to grow a God center survive better than rivals who did not? 2004b, page 14. We now have one eventually testable answer to Dawkins's question, and it invokes not just biochemical facts, but the whole world of cultural anthropology. Why did those with the genetic tendency survive? Because they, unlike those who lacked the gene, had health insurance. In the days before modern medicine, shamanic healing was your only recourse if you fell ill. If you were constitutionally impervious to the ministrations that the shamans had patiently refined over the centuries, cultural evolution, you had no health care provider to turn to. If the shamans had not existed, there would have been no selection advantage to having this variant gene. But their accumulated memes, their culture of shamanic healing, could have created a strong ridge of selection pressure in the adaptive landscape that would not otherwise have been there. This still doesn't get us to organized religion, but it does get us to what I am going to call folk religion, the sorts of religion that have no written creeds, no theologians, no hierarchy of officials. Before any of the great organized religions existed, there were folk religions, and these provided the cultural environment from which organized religions could emerge. Folk religions have rituals, stories about gods or supernatural ancestors, prohibited and obligatory practices. Like folk tales, the sayings of folk religion are of such distributed authorship that it is better to say that they have no authors at all, not that their authors are unknown. Like folk music, the rituals and songs of folk religion have no composers, and their taboos and other moral injunctions have no legislators. Conscious, deliberate authorship comes later, after the designs of the basic cultural items have been honed and polished for many generations, without foresight, without intent, by nothing but the process of differential replication during cultural transmission. Is all this possible? Of course. Language is a stupendously intricate and well-designed cultural artifact, and no individual human designers get to take credit for it. And just as some of the features of written languages are clearly vestigial traces of their purely oral ancestors, some of the features of organized religion will turn out to be vestigial traces of the folk religions from which they are descended. By vestigial traces, I mean this: the preservation over many generations of a folk religion, its self-replication in the face of inexorable competition, demands adaptations that are peculiar to an oral tradition, and that are no longer strictly necessary, from a reverse engineering point of view, but that persist simply because they haven't yet been sufficiently costly to be